Welcome all back. No, that turned on. Welcome back to the Aquaculture Management Advice. That loud. Aquaculture Management Advisory Committee. As we reconvene to discuss a variety of issues, we're going to go around the table so we have a record of who was here. I'm going to start at the far end. Ann.
Ann Gallivan, J.C. Long Brothers.
Jay Ford, CBF.
Kim Husky, Cherry Sun Aqua Farms.
Becky Kubin, City of Virginia Beach.
Russ Perkinson.
Mike Osterling, Shellfish Growers of Virginia.
Carolyn Ledford, Pleasure Household.
AJ Erskine, Bevan's Oyster Company, and Coward Seafood.
Beth Stagg, VMRC.
Ellen Bolin, VMRC.
Andrew Button, VMRC.
Also noting that we have Hank Badger from VMRC here as well. I think we also have one person on the phone today.
Yes, this is
Mark Lupin. Okay. Some of you have asked in the past if we do have the ability to do phone conferencing in. It's relatively new for us, so we do have that capacity. It does make it hard. We'll see. We'll get Mark's review after the meeting to see sort of how he was able to hear. On that note, if when you guys speak, you could speak into your microphones, both for Mark to be able to hear you, as well as when we go through the minutes, being able to identify who was saying what, when, and being able to get all of your wonderful comments. So for today, we're going to give a quick update of what has happened since last we spoke, and then we're going to go into the conversation around renewal criteria and sort of what we hope to get out today. So last we spoke, we've gotten your impact and largely your blessing on doing a $150 fee for renewals. We took that before the commission last month, and it passed unanimously, 6-0. Yay! Thank you guys for all your help on that. That will go into effect starting October 1. So Ben has sent out lease renewal notifications this week and last week, starting that process. So we won't hear from people about that, and we won't really is the start date for that. So as you guys might remember, we had a couple of different things we needed to accomplish as a committee, other than just general advice from the community to MRC on broader shellfish needs, and that is trying to develop guidelines around two things, around renewal criteria as well as a lot of different names. I'm not going to get wrapped around the actual long terms, use plans, beneficial use for lease applications. We chose to start at the end of this process looking at renewal criteria, largely because we were going through all the renewal fees and it just made sense to start there. The document that we sent to y'all is a straw man. It is intended to be shot at. If you can shoot nicely, that would be greatly appreciated. We know this is a contentious issue. We know this is going to be a challenging issue. So for the purposes of today's conversation, we're not pushing for consensus. We're not pushing for an end goal. We just want to hear your thoughts about what we've laid out, your concerns, your suggestions if you have them. We can see that would be really helpful. So we're not trying to reach kumbaya here today, so we would just really like to hear from you all in the past. So the final note before I run through this and open it up to you all is some of the consistent feedback we have heard from you all, which feels really good, is that you have a lot of faith in MRC staff and their knowledge base and their decisions, which is really great when those MRC staff are still here. And what's becoming increasingly clear to MRC, for those of you who don't know, Rob O'Reilly is retiring, is that we are going to start losing some of these staff, and that a single person's knowledge base is not sufficient or a stand-in for an agency policy. So again, love that you guys have faith in Ben and Hank, so do we. But we also have to think beyond in the next 3 to 5 to 10 years about how do we create a lasting policy that other staff can have that ensures regulatory consistency for you all, so that you don't feel like you're at the mercy of the next person that comes in. Something to think about as we move forward. Any initial questions where we run through the document? Mike?
Pretty basic question.
High pitch, it's too close.
I know when we worked on the SAV guidelines, once a document was agreed upon, it went to the commission, and the commission more or less voted on it and accepted it as policy. Is that your plan for this, to eventually take it before the commission and have the commission give it their blessing as policy?
Yes. Yes. Our goal is to get a document, a policy document that is guidelines. It doesn't. It's not in regulation, which was the strong feedback we got from the committee. And that also gives us a few years of running through the guidelines to see, you know, do we need something that has the force of law and regulation? Do we need that? But the intent is to take it before the commission and get a blessing. Yeah. AJ.
I think this is a comment that doesn't matter really, the document draft, you know, whatever we negotiate, I guess, or talk about in here, but whatever comes out of this committee, or even this document existing, I would appreciate it if it goes before SMAC. And the reason I say that is, you know, we're AMAC, I get it, you know, we're aquaculture and everything, but this will strongly impact a lot of members on that committee. And I think it's very important that they know what's going on up front. I don't think there's an emergency to this. You know, we're talking about developing the guidelines and, you know, what have you. I think they really need to be aware of, you know, what's expected.
Andrew, any concerns with that? Is that doable?
Yeah.
Okay. Excellent.
Immediately they meet next week, I think.
Oh, okay. Oh, that is convenient. Yeah. Andrew's like, agenda. What else? Any others before we get started? Sure. Start again, one more time.
Ann Gallivan, J.C. Walker Brothers.
Jay Ford, Chesapeake Bay Foundation.
Kim Hopke, Cherrystone Aqua Farms.
Tommy Leggett, Oyster Farmer, Chesapeake Seafood.
Becky Kubin, City of Virginia Beach.
Russ Perkinson, Private Citizen.
Mike Osterling, Shellfish Growers of Virginia.
Beverly Ledford, Pleasure House Oysters.
A.J. Erskine, Babbins Oyster Company, Coward Seafood.
Ed Stagg, BMRC.
Ellen Boland, BMRC.
Andrew Button, BMRC.
And Hank Badger, BMRC. You're welcome. I know. Okay, so we're going to start going through this. That was me hitting that. We're going to start going through this document, and I think the place really to start is just with the guidelines and some of our thinking around how this would actually work and what our rationale was. So there has been a lot of conversation about what a production standard would look like. So let me get all the way through this before we go after that. So right now, as it happens, and I should have said this in the beginning, the other thing is that as staff goes through these, particularly as staff changes and you need a written policy document, there will have to be some sort of standard as a starting point. And so by having this conversation now, it is very important to staff to be transparent with this. So there's not a question for you all of, is it one bushel this year and 10 bushels for the next person? So this is also some of our rationale in terms of being transparent and having this conversation. So the initial thinking as we went through this for standards is, it is the standard we had previously discussed. It was the standard that was used when Hank and Ben did the tabletop exercise on lease renewals, which is one bushel of effort per acre per year. And that's pretty low. Like, we got really mixed reviews, sort of as a reminder, we got really mixed reviews from you all of no production standard and, well, that one's really low. So we just kept this one for the purposes of the conversation. So as we would flow through this as an agency, what it would look like is, if a lease renewal came in and it met that criteria, it's likely going to get approved. I mean, that's a very minimum standard. And we have a couple of different ways to check that. We have the documentation sent in with the renewal, and we also have mandatory reporting. There is an issue over here with mandatory reporting and syncing those up, which will come up. But for right now, that's how it would work. If that lease did not meet that production standard, that does not mean it would automatically not be renewed. It means it gets kicked to a different category and a different set of criteria. And we have laid out a lot of those here based on your suggestion. So that includes lease for broodstock, wet storage, shell turning, restoration efforts, water quality, erosion control, rotation with other leased areas, future expansion, provided the expansion is a time frame, planned time frame, float or other permitted aquaculture activity, buffer productive area, education, ecotourism. So there's a lot of other factors that we could look at, and we have that broad sort of appeal. And then lastly, the the backstop we have for all of this is if your lease is denied, or lease renewal is denied, you always have the commission. You can always go to the commission and request that they review your case. But what we're trying to do is create some sort of method as we bring in a lot of those renewal areas. Ben, what am I missing?
Well, I'd say she's right. Production will get you in. The things she listed are the things we look at, and the overarching background of that is the actual code section. It talks about MSX and Dermo, 1205 criteria. So we have to weigh what you said you did, or what you did besides production that might qualify to renew it in the context of these other requirements, the public trust doctrine, title wetlands, SAV, adjacent properties, MSX and Dermo adjacent to a productive lease, those things that are hardwired into the code. So it's kind of like a three-step process. It's production's good, you're in. Not so much production that you make it. What other things did you do that you could qualify in this list of other factors? And then we have to weigh that with these factors that are in 613 and 1205. I mean, that's the way I look at it.
And the other thing, thank you, I skipped a whole section, thank you, Ben, is when we look at the other exemptions that are already in the code around MSX and Dermo and some of those things, we would also propose in guidelines to tighten up on those, which is if you are claiming, you know, you didn't have any production, but you did a bunch of shell, like that's trying to incur, like requiring receipts. If you're going to claim MSX and Dermo, requiring test results from them. So some of this is just providing documentation for what is in the existing law and code. So, pause there. I imagine there are some thoughts. Yes.
Right now, well, first off, I've been doing cage culture of oysters 25 years, probably longer than anybody outside of John B. and Jack White in the state right now, I think. But nevertheless, one of the older people doing this. I've been doing it for over 25 years. The way this is set up right now, I'm not sure that the three leases that I have would be renewed. One of the leases that I use would be, but that's where I report harvest from. The three leases that I have, I don't report harvest from, but they're integral to my operation. Now, more than likely, if Ben were here, and others were still here, it wouldn't be a problem. But when you have your new people come in, you know, I'm going to have to go through hoops to keep my leases. Number one, I don't plant bushels. I plant half-liter bags of seed, half liters at a time. So I plant 325 bags with 1,000 seed to the bag. It's about a half a liter. That's just ballparking. But that's 325,000 oysters a year. I'm a one-man operation. I supply two restaurants and one dealer, and that's how I make my living. So that's one thing. I don't plant bushels. None of the leases that I have in one of these guidelines that talks about immediate leases immediately adjacent to the others, none of the five leases that I use are adjacent to any of the others. That's another thing. Talked about wet storage. Everything I do is wet storage. Everything that an oyster farmer growing oysters in cages does is wet storage. We're storing oysters in bags or cages or something like that. But I don't want to have to get a freaking permit, another layer of bureaucracy to do this. Now, the reason I don't use the leases that I have to report harvest from is over the years we've had to, harvesting has gotten tighter because of the FDA, shellfish sanitation, warm weather regulations, and I've moved my harvest site as close to my dock as possible so that I have minimal time dock to dock. Right now, it's an hour or less for my level of harvest and effort each morning. One lease that I have at the Coast Guard Pier, it would add 30, 40 minutes to that time. When it's 90 and 100 degrees, that's significant. So that's one of the reasons that I don't use the other leases, but I use the leases to store oysters or husbandry, I'll say. When I plant my seed, it goes into shallow water protected areas. As it gets bigger, it goes to other places, but I'm not under constraints to do it in a half hour or 5 hours according to the FDA and the Shellfish Sanitation Department. So I've got leeway. But I move marketable oysters to a lease that I'm using that's close to my dock so that I can jump in the boat at 6 in the morning and be back to my dock at 7 or sooner. So that's me as a small oyster grower, and I suspect a lot of us that do this kind of stuff experience the same sorts of things. So I'm not in favor of any of that right now.
So I have a question. What would you suggest language that would cover you better? I think broodstock, the first one, sort of covers what you're saying, but should we say
I don't want
sort of seed production and broodstock?
I don't want sort of. You know,
sort of. Yeah, Mike is using the word sort of.
I have no idea what to put, but you know, I'm kind of with Mike Oesterling on metrics. You know, this is going to bite us and burn us in the butt somewhere down the line. And I don't know the answer, and I respect what y'all are trying to do, but I've been burned a couple of times by regulations that were meant to do something good and help out, and I lost a crab pot license because of that. And, you know, so I don't have a whole lot of faith in a lot of these regulations and things that we're trying to do here. So to answer your question, Ben, I don't know.
Anybody else have a suggestion?
For something on the husbandry side of things, you have, I mean, actually your husbandry permits come across, we'll have documentation of those leases being used for that, but the agency, that might be something you could...
Well, I'm happy to write out a plan,
right. But
I don't want to have to do it every year, and it's not going to change as long as I'm doing this. So it would say something like I plant seed in Sarah Creek, Perrin River on my lease and on Grand Blake's lease. Oysters are moved out a certain size to my Coast Guard lease, to my York River lease, and as they become market size, they're moved to the Shannon Fedora's lease, and that's where I harvest from, something to that effect, and justify why I'm doing that. If that'll pass and I don't have to go through public hearings and all that kind of garbage, I'm fine. But I don't want to have to go through this every year.
And just to clarify, this would be for we're looking at this for the 10-year renewal. So this would just be capturing for the past. Okay.
I mean, I might not even be doing this in 10 years. I'm hoping. I'm spending a lot more time in the Caribbean in 10 years.
That sounds awesome.
Future. That's an option.
Sorry, we digress.
But there's a lot of people here, like
okay.
Dan, who's a lot younger than me.
I just wanted to mention something to follow up on that. And I agree with 100% everything you've said. But I have a couple of things to follow up. Number one, you might not, and I might not either, be doing this in 10 years. I think I'm getting a little bit older every year. And it just happens. But anyway, I think it's important to note that I have leases that are going to come up for renewal next year. So it isn't 10 years, it's next year. And I may or may not have kept records on educational things. I have some. I know that I do. Mm-hmm. And we have people that we can call up and say, oh, a friend in school, remember that thing we did with your, you know, this grade hole, you know, teachers, blah, 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 you know, send me something now. But we have to remember that the guidelines are expecting us to have documentation that we didn't maybe know we were going to have 9 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's important that we think about the fact that, you know, there's a lot of time and effort going back and trying to recoup. We had a grant from the Department of Agriculture for shelling, and so most of you all know these things about us, and so we put down shell, and you know, I can call them up or I can send you a copy of the application. In other words, what I'm doing is I'm playing catch up for stuff that I never thought. Now, starting today, I can keep records or keep folders on each of the leases and say, this is what I've been doing on these leases, just like, you know, for my documentation. But I may not be able to go back 9 years ago
mm-hmm.
and remember, have a lot of paper to go through to do that kind of thing. So that's one thing I want to follow up on, that is that it isn't 10 years from now. It could be as soon as next year or next October. We can have a lease come due in October and have to produce 10 years worth of documentation because we didn't actually record harvest reports or part of the bushel per year per acre for that lease. We'd have to go back and say what we've been doing with that retrospectively when you know. Now, having said that, I would like to add to that because of, and this is just my baby, only me, but other people might have this issue too, we have areas that are closed and open conditionally because of rain. We've got one closed right now that we harvest our market oysters for our three restaurants, about the size of here, you know. And so we have another location that we only use the oysters when we're closed because it's not conditional. It's open all the time, but we don't take those. So they may not, we may not harvest from them for 4 or 5 months, 6 months at a time because it hasn't rained 10, you know, an inch in 24 hours and we're not closed for 10 days. So to keep up with the minutia of documentation of why we only harvested on that lease 1 month during this particular time frame, which could be a year, would be another, yet another thing that I might not be able to go back 9 years and recover. Mm-hmm. You know, I might be able to. I've got my health department closure letters in a folder that I keep chronologically, but my mind is thinking about what I have to produce when I didn't know I was going to have to keep the records.
Mm-hmm. So that's a challenge we're facing as well, that this law is applied to be blown a little bit retroactively, because particularly for the first leases that come up under renewal, they're at the beginning of this process. So I'm guessing the first 2 to 4 years we're going to run into a lot of this, and we'll have a lot of staff conversations and probably more than one case before the commission as we try to grapple with this. Mike?
I think Tommy actually pointed out something that you alluded to in your opening comments, and that is subjectivity of the staff, mm-hmm. whoever it is. They're going to have to understand that Tommy's operation is different from AJ's operation, is different from Bev's operation, is different from everyone else's operation. And somewhere, we're going to have to rely on your staff to be thorough and objective in evaluating the information that's provided. I know that the first one that Ben sent out, the first denial a month or so ago, created a lot of controversy.
Okay.
And I expect you're going to have more, even with your guidelines. So while I appreciate that you want a list of something you can give somebody, we're still going to see subjectivity come into the decisions on the renewal. I don't think you're going to be able to get away from that.
I agree with that. I mean, so we're going to do Russ, then Tommy, then Jay. I mean, when you have humans making decisions, there's always some subjectivity. But what I think there's two ways to look at it. There's it being subjective, but there's also a little bit more certainty for you all of, like, if I get into these boxes and these criterias, I'm probably going to be okay. So it is subjectivity, but we're also trying to have some regulatory guideline certainty. So you don't feel like it's a constantly shifting ground based on the staff you have here. So we're trying to sort of find that middle point, I guess. Russ?
Yeah, minor point. I'm thinking about what was said about the seed effort and that sort of thing and how that relates to a bushel of effort. This is a combined harvest planting effort, one bushel of effort per acre. And I think when staff described this before, they may have even said equivalent effort, you know, something equivalent to that. So I would suggest if you stick with any of this language, third paragraph, fourth line, that you insert after harvest / planting effort, one bushel of effort or equivalent. And that covers things like somebody that's dealing with quarts of seed is obviously, you know, a bushel, you know, worth of seed is probably worth a lot more than a bushel of shell or harvest, mm-hmm. as far as in the whole mix of things. So I think that would help a little bit, at least with not everything was raised, but at least one issue.
would be happy to provide my husbandry write-up and expand on it and tie it to my harvest, which is in mandatory reporting. And I would suspect that what I harvest annually would qualify to keep me in the business and keep the leases. But I would have to tie all the leases together and what I do and how I do it and use that as something to go by for people like me and Bev and other small growers. I mean, even for Cowart and Bevins and bigger people, they've got leases that are not adjacent. And they do similar things to what I'm doing, but on a much larger scale. So I'd be happy to do that and see if that would pass the test for new staff that come in. And if that qualifies, I don't see why that wouldn't work. And it's not, I mean, it would be clear, I think, that what I harvest and what I produce would qualify as significant.
It was Jay and Kim and Mike. Speaking into the microphone, Jay, it's hard to hear you.
Yeah, going back to Beth's point, I think this is that feels like something we should be able to deal with in advance. There's concerns that we're not going to have adequate documentation, we should be discussing a grandfather clause rather than throwing our hands up and saying there's no answer to this. I mean, that's a legitimate concern, particularly, you know, I've been banging on record keeping for putting down shell. No one's ever had to do it before. How can you ask them to do it mid-lease? It's important, but we do need to build that in, I think, on the front end. So we shouldn't be throwing our hands up and saying it's just going to be subjective for this first go-round. And particularly if we're just putting forward a non-legal framework, you know, basically suggestions, it seems pretty easy to put in a suggestion that says if somebody's permit's coming up for renewal 5 years into this new process, then we shouldn't have expectations that they had documentation that wasn't required before.
Okay. Kim, I think you were next.
I did. So, two things. One, the comment about these are guidelines. Mm-hmm. I very much appreciate that. But I'd also have to say that in the absence of a regulation that defines what we're trying to get to, the guidelines become the default regulation. Because the commission, from what I'm understanding, is staff will be relying on the guidelines. The commission will be relying on the guidelines. So, again, in absence of regulation, guidelines become regulation, if that makes any sense. So I have a concern there, but I understand that we need to start somewhere. And the other thing is, I would echo AJ's comments about all of this going before SMAC, because whereas I totally get what Tommy's saying and what Bev is saying on the wild harvest side of this and the leases that are held wild harvest, I'm not sure the one bushel per acre per year would fit. And maybe, Andrew, you can help me answer that. But we have some very large leases that I think that matrix would be very difficult to achieve.
Yeah. In terms of maintaining production on a wild harvest, that lease wouldn't be productive if you were only planting one bushel of shells or seed per year. I mean, over the 10-year period, if you weren't at least harvesting that or at least planting that, there wouldn't be probably anything there but mud anyway. So, I mean, that's just on the wild side of things. I mean, there are some leases that have been planted maybe 15 years ago that are just being planted again that might still have some production there, but that production would catch you if they were still a resource there. So either the production of a bushel a year would be there, or if you're actually making it productive, I think that's almost nothing on a wild harvest, that one bushel per year after. But
what, if I can follow up real quick with Andrew, what would happen to our bay leases? Because we have some pretty large bay leases. What would happen to those under these guidelines?
I haven't looked at those leases specifically, but I'm not sure what acreages would be there, but it would be all sort of harvests coming off there. But most of those leases are 500 or 600 acres, I would say. So, I mean, if you're not planting that much shell in 10 years, then probably you're not using all of that bay lease, I would say. So there might be portions of it that you are using and are planting on that level. I mean, if it's a 250-acre lease, one tank of spat-on shell planting covers you for the full 10 years. So it's not a...
But I'm sorry. I thought this was per acre per year.
Per year. I mean, cumulative. If you have 2 acres and you do 20 bushels at one time, you've done it for 10 years.
Yes, I understand. But you were talking about a bushel.
Right, I guess it would be
per year.
Per year, yeah.
It's really per acre per year.
That they can it be combined?
Yeah. You could do it in the first year or the ninth year.
And that's trying to get out over the average.
Right.
So I understand that there are leases that are used in conjunction that may or may not be adjacent to each other. If there were a report that were submitted to explain how they went together, does the harvest from one, like if Tommy's only harvesting from one lease, but he's doing husbandry on the other leases, but he has more than one bushel per acre per year on the one because they're all rotating through there, does that somehow give credit to these other leases? Or could it?
Yes.
what's your next person going to say?
Well, okay. Let's talk a minute. Let me say a couple things about some of the comments that we made. So the criteria is the law. Okay, that's the criteria, not the guidance document. The law says, the main thing the law says for renewal is, renew a lease that requires significant production and reasonable planting. Okay? So that right there is objective. Okay? Reasonable is reasonable. More important person. Significant is also subjective. So right off the bat, you've got a subjective law. My view is these guidelines are just to try to help us and help industry. If you can't meet this first thing, significant production and reasonable planting, you have some other things in the law that will allow us to renew the lease. And yes, it's all subjective, okay? Let's just say that right out. This law is not written with specific criteria. We could make more specific, and we're trying to do a little bit of that with the guideline, with the one bushel of effort. That's really the only real hard criteria we put in these guidelines, and we still think that's pretty minimal. I understand there's large bay leases, but you can claim buffers that you have a 200-acre lease, but you're only using 100 acres, but you're using some of that as a buffer, you're using inside, keeping people, I mean, all those are in there. And I agree with Tommy, a production plan, write it one time, and you submit that whenever one of your leases is coming up, and say, this is one of my leases that's part of this production plan. When I write a permit for aquaculture, a permit, in the future, particularly, we are going to start requiring a plan. It's really required by the ISSC if it's a floating aquaculture type thing. So I'm not saying you're going to have to submit a full-blown plan when you apply for a lease, but I think when you ask to renew it, if you have Tommy circumstances or Beverly circumstances, when you might have used it for education, yeah, you need to collect some of those documents. But if you have a plan, if you have an operational plan, just submit that. It doesn't have to be unique every time you submit. It can be an overall operational plan. Again, a lot of this is subjective. I can't deny that. And I can't tell you what the next person after me is going to do. But my thinking for these guidelines is to give industry some broad outline of things. If you can't meet production and planting, look at these other things. And are you doing some of them? Put that on the form. The reason the lease got denied that Mike talked about was they didn't put anything on there that they were doing that they later said they were doing, but it was not production related. They were using it for experimentation. And a lot of things that I said, put that on the form, that's what I need. So the purpose, I think, of these guidelines is to give you what we think are things that qualify. And I understand, y'all, you know, the industry's concern that we're going to catch somebody in this net and throw their lease out. If it goes to the, if we do that and it goes to the commission makes the decision. And it's still subjective by the commission. That's just citizens that look at the data that I report, they're gonna look at what you say you did, and they're gonna make a decision, and it's still subjective. So, I think we're working well together, but that's my thinking on this, and yeah, shoot at this thing. We want you to shoot at it. I think things have been said already. I agree with Tommy, I probably didn't capture the exact kind of thing you do in this document. Talked about broodstock and wet storage. Well, you're right, you don't want to have to get a wet storage permit. Broodstock is not exactly what you're doing with seed, but that's the kind of thing we want to hear is what kind of activities are you doing that need to be captured here that we can consider. So I'll get off my soapbox.
Okay.
Just
Beverly and then Russ and then Mike with the hands I think I saw that went up. And then Ann, sorry.
I just wanted to mention that on the part that says it's on the second page. It's the second half of C, or the third, the last third of C, where it says other factors.
Mm-hmm.
I think that just to help, it should be other factors to be considered by the commission, not may also, because I think these other factors are just as important as the first set of bullets. I'm just recommending that. Particularly where what I call, and maybe everybody doesn't call it the same, I call it grow out activity. Husbandry is another way of putting that, but where you have certain leases where you're actually, the seed grows out better because of the depth of the water and the amount of flow and to all kinds of things. There's all kinds of reasons to start seed out one place and then as they get larger and, you know, healthier and all that kind of thing, you know, rotating them to another lease, which may not be adjacent, 100% may not be adjacent. The other, one other comment I'd like to make, and we don't have to do it right now, but I would be interested in hearing what VMRC staff describe as a 10-year unused lease. What would that look like? You know, what is that description? To play the devil's advocate, show me or talk to me about what, how when you have an application, you send them the form to renew their lease, what would that look like that would automatically get a denial? You don't have, not now, but down the road as we discuss this.
Okay. Russ, and then Mike, and then Ann.
I would support staff's suggestion of a some type of management plan for these, not necessarily for all operations, but these cases where different leases are used for different purposes and integrate, and more like an integrated management plan that integrates all the leases. So if some are just used for finishing, basically, and it, I would presume those leases probably be more productive on a, you know, bushel basis than somebody is just flat out using leases or, you know, straight through production, but it would allow you a way to see how things fit together and show, you know, how the owner of the lease or the lessee use how they fit together and how they're used. And it, you know, it would be a little better information to look at. I would suggest even you consider writing that into this document for, you know, again, not necessarily for all cases, but those cases where different leases are used for different facets of the operation, you know, the production cycle. The other thought I had on the comment made about the may be considered on page 3, the things on page 2 strikes me as I think they're all in statute. So, you know, they need to be considered, I suppose. Ones on page 3, they really are may. I mean, those are things I don't see in the statute specifically. place it. It's kind of like extra things to consider. So I'm not sure. I kind of like the word may, because it distinguishes between what's in the statute and what's not.
Okay. Mike?
I just want to get back to the adjacent comment again. I actually had a member say that they felt the term immediately adjacent is going to be problematic, specifically for what Tommy just described. There are a lot of people that have leases that are not adjacent to each other, but are used in their production. So you might want to consider, instead of immediately adjacent, or other leases that are connected to the business.
So I believe, and I will probably be corrected if I'm wrong.
It's in the code.
It's in the code.
The word immediately is in the code.
Yeah, directly, immediately adjacent is in the code.
The beneficial to the production of waste planning grounds is immediately adjacent to the refinery.
But if we do what we talked about and say other factors that would be considered, it could say buffer of a productive area within the lease or another lease part of the operation.
Yes. Okay, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, I mean.
That sentence is, if you read that sentence literally, it makes no sense.
Right.
Because it's talking about the lease renewing.
Yeah.
That lease is beneficial to it, a lease adjacent to it.
Well, if you can't meet the production on that one, how is it beneficial to it?
I mean, I don't really understand what that means when I read it, but I just know it says immediately adjacent.
Yeah, I see that in the...
It seems like it should say the lease next to you is growing oysters. Let me renew this one because I think it's a migration or something, a scheme. But it's actually written the opposite way, which makes it problematic. But
then somewhere in here,
okay,
you have to get the message across that someone's leases does not have to be contiguous, and they're still going to be considered in the production.
I was doing that already. You said that.
Yeah.
If you put that down in the comment section and say, you know, I have a lease that's two leases over, and I use that to proceed, or, you know, vice versa. So I definitely considered that in the past, but just the intent, we believe, of this law is to be a little more strict here on renewing leases. And that's a good question that we asked. What is one that's not acceptable? I can definitely bring you some back that I would turn down, other than the ones that just don't turn the form. Right? I mean, that's one I can tell you right off the bat. No form? What choice do I have? But we have turned down some that with 0%, the effort is so minimal, and no comment.
I think Ann had a comment.
I think one of the biggest issues that feels like it's coming out is that for shellfish harvesting, whether it's wild, whether it's aquaculture, the way that it's done, it is so dramatically different from what Tommy does, from what AJ does, what Terrystone does, what J.C. Walker Brothers does, is that trying to limit us in the details is almost limiting us in our methodology. So even though Tommy says for the next 10 years I'm going to use this, somebody might come to him and say, you know, here's a piece of ground, you might consider growing this in your operation. And then 9 years later, he'll totally forgot that he changed his plan. The reason why Virginia is so successful is that we've always been able to be adaptive to the situation. I always said that the seaside is so dynamic that for our leases and how we use them, it's not only in broodstock, it's in nursery, so it's in all phases of our aquaculture operation that we have the ability to go from one lease to the other because of storms or El Niños or winter mortality. Now, even sitting here, I'm thinking on the Bayside, it's just as dynamic, but in different circumstances. I see winter mortality, I see triploid mortality, I see low salinity of things affecting, you know, and that's not going to be documented. That's not going to be disease documented. There's no way to document that, but it affects us every day. And we have to adapt to it at a moment's notice. I've had to go out and kick cages and move things because of an icing event or a hurricane that was coming. And I can't remember or say or document, oh, let me write that down because in 10 years I'm going to have to prove that I've used this lease. So I think we've been successful working with you because there's been less details required, but we've had faith in you to understand this, but limiting us in the saying, here's the guidelines. I can think of 100 things that haven't been mentioned now that we do either on the seaside or on the bayside that haven't even been mentioned, and it might not be mentioned, or when it comes up for renewal, I might forget that it's been mentioned or that I need to document it. So I'm just concerned. And I rather see that you've used our mandatory reporting before using your metrics of one bushel per acre. Because if you use mandatory reporting, not necessarily for the lease that's coming up,
mm-hmm.
but for, all right, this company or this person that has been reporting, all for you have 5 leases, you haven't reported on this lease, but you've reported on the 4 other ones. Maybe that might be a better priority than the production.
I think it was Russ, then AJ, then Tommy, but a note on that, which Ben might be able to speak to a little better. You know, we first threw out mandatory reporting, I think, at one of the early meetings and got some not insignificant amount of pushback. Because in a lot of ways, for Ben, who's doing this now, to come in and click on mandatory reporting, it's all linked in his system. So the lease renewal comes in, and he can click on mandatory reporting. So in terms of simplicity and like step one for us, that's pretty easy to do. So agree that it does make a lot of sense. One of the things that has come up as we've gone through all this is there are some, I think I said, pretty big discrepancies between the mandatory reporting issues, and that is one of the things that I think this will hopefully result in a much tighter understanding of, because we're having some big discrepancies in terms of what people are reporting. Sometimes it's because they're reporting everything from one lease, and it turns out it actually came from other leases. But again, like the law requires you to report, laws pretty specific requirements on what you are required to report. So I'm all for improving mandatory reporting. I'm all for using that as a criterion as a first step. But we had received pretty vocal feedback that was not necessarily a step others were comfortable with. And so we backed off that significantly, just to let you know where we came from. The next thing I will add before we go back to the table is at the very halfway through the bottom of the 4th page, the other thing it says is the commission may consider other factors if deemed appropriate. Because we're never going to be able to list every single factor that comes up. And so again, what we're trying to do is provide a roughed out structure for staff to go through that gives them for, you know, 80% of the cases, 70% of the cases, we can run them through these filters and we can get out. There's going to be special cases that come out where we have to bring them to the commission versus we can't make a decision, we don't have the correct decision. The commission will always serve as that backstop. But this is not intended to be, if it's not on this list, it's excluded. This is just intended to give us a start. I lost my order. Russ, AJ, Tom.
2 points. The first, which is more of a question, but the statute mentions diseases. How does staff handle, or how would you handle a situation where there's a BDH closure? There's a bacteria, for example. Let's say it would be different if it's a seasonal closure versus a complete closure. How would you handle that if somebody wants to renew the lease, there wasn't any production because it's condemned, but maybe they want to hang on to it in case someday there's a TMDL done on it?
I get that. I get renewal requests where they basically don't put much of anything down for definitely no harvest, and they write at the very bottom, area is condemned. Well, historically, since this law has been on the book, which is quite a few years now, we've routinely told people, before I was doing this, condemnation is not an excuse to not propagate shellfish, period. So So if you made no effort, you made no effort, you didn't meet the code criteria. The lease is closed for 10 consecutive years, and you made no effort, then I don't have any problem not renewing your lease. If you made an effort, I will consider that. Obviously, you probably didn't harvest, although you could have, if it's not completely restricted. If you can relay off of it, if you grow oysters, you could actually relay them to a clean area and harvest them. So, or move them as seed. So, traditionally, we, and that's why you don't see that in this document. I don't see anything in here about condemnation. It's not in the code. It talks about diseases, but it talks about MSX and dermat. That's different than bacterial or aquatical closure. And yes, we have rain events. We have closures from sewer breaks, but they don't last 10 years.
I've talked to people occasionally that have leases, so they, I know in one case they say lease was taken away from them, and then of course things got better and somebody else, they wanted it back, and somebody else lead them to it or something. So anyway, it's sort of it's a little bit of a rub. This, the other point of, so I was going to wonder if that ought to be added to your May list, but leave it up to y'all to think about. The other thing about the May list, it strikes me, you got floats mentioned, and correct me if I'm wrong, floats are just another method of production. So the floats, if they exist, would count towards the one bushel of effort anyway, so I don't like having floats or any particular production method listed out. That is one of the more impactful things on people that are not in agriculture production that have to live with it. So I would suggest the float bullet be struck, because I think it's already covered elsewhere in the, if you've got floats and you're producing oysters in them, you're probably meeting the one bushel of effort.
Possibly, but I don't be surprised that there are people that have a lease and have floats of us and don't realize that we would count that towards production over the lease. There's, you don't have to have the lease. The lease is not really, you have to have a permit.
Okay.
But they still have to report the harvest. So if they had no lease, they would have to report the harvest as a permit. So that's really technically how they're probably going to report it. If they have floats over the lease, they may not report it that they harvested it off the lease. But they're encumbering that area over the lease with the floats. We don't have to give them credit for that. I don't think industry will be happy about that if they have some leases, so they're really not doing any bottom activity at all.
I wasn't suggesting, Ben, that they not get any credit for that if they got a lease. I was saying it's already credited, and if I understand correctly, unless they got a permit without a lease somewhere.
Right, but the mandatory reporting may not show any harvest on that lease. It may be reported as float agriculture, by permit.
If they got a lease, so it still seems, I'm just telling you the thing I've got the largest objection to in the whole thing. It's probably that one bullet.
Can I pull that thread a little bit of why, since it is an established method of aquaculture, is it just your concern that if we had it on here, are you worried it would incentivize it? Can you talk a little bit more about why
it gives the appearance that it's something special that's good, and there are some benefits to floats, no question about it, from a production perspective. There's some negative impacts as well. So I just, we don't pull out and talk about bottom cages in here separately. We don't talk about traditional culture. We don't talk about other production methods. So you're, for some reason, I'll move back like there a little bit. For some reason, that was thrown in as a special circumstance or something, and I don't think it's needed, or I'd like to see it out of the list, because I think it's already covered, or somebody seems like they'd have a way they could report that as production.
Okay. I think appreciate that. I think what we'll probably go back to do is ask staff to talk about this, because this came up as something we may actually need to specifically call out, because we're talking about least bottom, and those cages by definition are not on the bottom. So clarifying credit. But I hear you, and I think we need to circle back among staff and try to figure out a little bit better way to word that or ensure that there is credit for those things. So I'm going to go AJ and then Tommy and then Becky and then
in here
AJ.
I didn't see it.
Okay.
So that's, you know, because I did look for that, I think, because I wondered that. Sorry.
No, that's helpful. We'll take a look at that. AJ?
So I was just going to go back a little bit to the time before this committee, but the Secretary's work group
mm-hmm.
in Richmond that met several times and discussed lease renewal, not as much as some of the other topics, but albeit discussed, you know, renewals, discuss the fee, but the guidelines, I guess, or you know, what we're talking about here. And there was some discussion, if I recall, from several people around a concept of multiple leases, not all of which would show production.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it was brought up that if, similar to what Ann said, if there's some leases within a business or a company that has productivity via mandatory reporting or some other documentation, that all the leases within that business would qualify as being renewed as part of the overall business plan. And I recall that was discussed maybe or brought up in that secretary's work group several times. So I certainly don't see it on this list, but I think it's worthwhile talking about at this. What I see here is a good reference document, and I think it's very important. It brings up a lot of good points. My concern is having a hard quantitative metric in this document. It's guidance. A lot of guidance gets turned into its regulation. I don't think there's, I might be wrong, Ben, that there's a need for a hard metric at this point. Guidance means you can come back to it and modify that guidance. So I like the other things we're talking about, but I don't like the hard quantitative metric unless we have something about these businesses that have been built and have multiple leases but might not meet these criteria or the quantitative criteria. You would look at them in a whole or as a whole if there's productivity on the other business leases.
So when I first spoke, I was telling you that I plant like 1,000 seed to a bag, and that's roughly a half a liter. So that was the middle of April when I got my seed. When I got my seed, they were 2 millimeters. When I planted them, they were like 1/4 inch. As of now, 3 months later, it's about 4 bags of seed equals 1 bushel. So what I've essentially got now overboard is about 81 bushels. This is just for me. This is just 1 year. This is just one or two places, and everybody's different.
Right.
But that's roughly what I've got for my 325,000 seed. Equals 81 bushels of seed right now, single, cultless, individual seed.
And how many acres?
Many acres?
Yeah. So you said you had 81 bushels. I'm just curious about how
many acres I use. I've got one lease is 27, one lease is 24. In front of my house is 6/10, and Sarah Creek is 9, and then 15. So 27, 24, 30, 57, 66, 81 acres.
81 acres.
Yeah, 81 bushels.
81 bushels.
Yeah.
Well,
that's
not
worked out.
3 weeks, Tommy, you're going to have 160 bushels.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's...
I'm just throwing that out, just giving you some numbers.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's
roughly what we
that's helpful. That's helpful. So
yeah,
I'm trying to be curious if,
I'm doing.
If the math was, that worked out pretty well.
Yeah, well, I didn't think of that, but.
I don't want to have to go that route.
Yeah.
I like what AJ was saying. And what I said before, writing up a plan, describing what we do, incorporating and tying everything together, mandatory reporting.
I will say that the more information you all give us on these renewals, the easier it is. When we get, I'm speaking for Ben right now, because he does this, you're welcome. You know, if you include this information on the lease forms, it makes it a lot easier. So the line that the staff is trying to walk is, we want, you know, what we heard consistently for the past year is we want to crack down on bad actors. We want to ensure leased ground is being used productively, right? That was the constant and consistent refrain we heard during the secretary's working group. MRC said, okay, message received. You know, secretary was like, why aren't you, for those of you in the room, secretary was like, why aren't you denying more of these leases? So we heard that message. Come, we get through the law, we come here, we talk to you all, and we have to implement this. We're also trying to balance that with the unique aspects of the industry, that many growers are different, and how to balance all of that with not trying to have this attitude of every lease that comes in, we're like, okay, how do we deny it? That is not the attitude or the intent of this agency. I don't think it has ever been. I don't think it will ever be. But we're just trying to figure out what rough guidelines can we put down just to give us the sense of how to wrestle this to the ground. So our intent is we're trying to walk that line between making sure that the leased ground is productive, whatever that means. Like Den was saying earlier, it's subjective. So one second, Mike. I think I saw some hands at the end of the table. Jay, did you have your hand up? And Becky?
I did. I think it was, we were working our way down.
Okay. Becky and then Jay.
Okay, I had two one question and then a sort of comment, I guess. For the question, back on kind of the floats and other permitted aquaculture activity, so is that something, if you were to give a permit for that, is that something that would be allowed in someone else's lease?
Could be.
Does it happen? I mean, is the reason that they need to hold the lease so that they don't have to get that permission?
Any floating aquaculture needs a permit. Doesn't matter if you have a lease or not. Someone needs a permit.
But if somebody already had that space, then would you be able to get that permit?
If the leaseholder did not, if you had the leaseholder's permission, yes, it could be an independent party that uses the float area for their permit, and we would issue it as long as the leaseholder didn't object. He wouldn't object if it didn't interfere with his operation. If
right.
He dredged the ground, he might not want floats to vote because then he can't dredge it because they're in the way. But.
So if one of the leases is used for, you know, a systematic kind of multiple lease production, you would probably expect they would need to keep that lease in order to get that permit or maintain the permit for the floats. But it seems to me that if you have harvest records and you have this permit, that you may not even be getting to these other types of issues because you're already going to know that they're producing off of that lease. I mean, assuming they have enough.
The answer is yes. The agency will know that. I won't, because I'm doing them all right now. I'll probably know it. But that it may not be the future. You may do permitting back with Habitat. A Habitat engineer will issue the float permit. My database, leasing database, links to mandatory reporting. So I can look at the lease reporting, but I don't link straight to a permit that's over that lease. They don't click a lease. They put, I'm reporting on permit 2009-40. So that's my float permit. We have that internally in the agency. We can, but it's not tied together. That's
so they should, when they're submitting their plan and system or whatever, include any other permits that they have.
They would have to tell us they put it over a lease, and they'd have to have permission. So that would be part of the permit document. But we don't really have any linkage between the leasing database permitting database that would let me see that without them telling me that. Somebody's got to tell me that every time, unless I just have to remember it. Oh yeah, I remember issuing a permit.
All right, so the other thing that I don't really understand enough about how all this work and permissions from other leaseholders and that sort of thing, but that control issue of having to get the permission has always been where I have been coming from, because we were not able to do city projects because there were these leaseholders out there who held leases for decades, renewal upon renewal or transfer upon transfer, and never had a harvest report, and probably still haven't to this day. And that is very prevalent in the Lynn Haven within the city of Virginia Beach. So my interest is in making sure that if there were some project that we knew, you know, a seawall project or a, you know, sea level rise project or something that's not covered by our dredging exemption, or in some other locality where they have the same situation, and you have somebody who's just holding this lease basically on spec because it's been in their family and it's nice to hold, but they've never actually done anything with it. And then they come up for renewal because they can't transfer it anymore. So they come up for renewal and have nothing to show. I do want that to not renew. And I want to make sure that there's not some, you know, well, I'm just going to go out and dump 10 bushels of, I mean, some of these, most of these leases are pretty small, you know, 8-10 acres. Wouldn't be anything for them to go, I mean, I guess they'd have to do it over multiple years in order to get one per acre per year. That'd be quite a lot all at once, I suppose. But what I don't want is just some sort of catch-up where they're keeping control of it, where other oyster producers may want to use it, or other, I mean, to me, that's what this is for, is to make sure that when there are people who are just holding it, or holding on to a 300-acre lease where they're using 10 of it, you know, 10 acres over time, that they have a voluntary way to right-size it. Maybe they want to keep it. Maybe they want to reduce it to what they've actually been using. But what I don't want is it just to be continued in perpetuity because it's difficult to explain. And I do understand which they shouldn't have to make a guess as to how they're going to be using it over 10 years and then live by it. I think it should be retrospective. And you, at the time of the renewal, say how you have been using it. You know, we intended to do this, but we changed over time. This is what we're doing, and this, you know, this is how we did it. To me, that is something that makes sense. But just to, you know, have it go like it's been going with not a lot to show for it, and just to say, well, there was bacteria in the water, I couldn't grow anything, have no foreseeable ability to do it, I don't think it ought to renew.
I believe that's intent of the law, and I think that's what we are trying to capture this. So this is, I think the gig is up for some of the leases in the Lynn Haven system. They can't be transferred now. I mean, they could, but we're going to look at it. And at the 10-year renewal, it's the same thing. If you can't show, and yes, I mean, if they got enough money, they could go out and buy a barge load of shells on a 40-acre lease and plant enough to meet the one bushel of effort. They could. But if they do, they did. They met the criteria. And now they're shelled. Bushels will grow there. That's a good thing.
And likewise, though, doesn't the city hold leases?
We do, and we pack them by put shell down.
So my point is
we
that.
Knew,
I mean,
were,
you know,
if anybody was going to be looked at, it was going to be the city. So.
Well, I mean, you know, there are different reasons for holding leases. That's what we're getting at here, you know. And the city has leases, and they're going to have a requirement to propagate shellfish. So if they bring, if that leaseholder brings a barge load of shells in and does it in the ninth year, they do it in the ninth year. I mean.
But I think, too, can I speak?
Oh, yes.
No, I know many families that live on the Lynn Haven, have homes or front homes on the Lynn Haven, and they've had a couple-acre lease in front of their property, not riparian, a regular lease, you know, for generations. They grow oysters. They harvest oysters for their family, for their own use, personal use, which is perfectly legitimate. They have gone about it over the past generations, and these are people that, you know, we've met in working out there on the water and have talked with them about, you know, would they like to get some seed from us or different things. You just have a conversation. That's what we do, you know, out there. And my heart goes out to someone who, and we've talked to, we had a family that we worked with for a while, and unfortunately the matriarch passed away, and they decided to sell the house on the Lynn Haven, and subsequently, this is just a sad story, so I'm just going to tell it, okay? They sold the house, they tore it down, and they built four houses, okay? So we got in touch with the son and said, you know, what about your lease? Are you interested in us, you know, you can transfer it, buy it, whatever you want, use it, you know, what's going to happen now? You got four people. Well, you had one before, and y'all were using it for family use, and blah, 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 blah. Well, we hadn't thought about it. You know, we really hadn't thought about it. But we think we want to still grow oysters there for the same reason that we have for years, to harvest them and have them for personal use. you know, it didn't mean they lost their oyster lease because they sold their property. So I think that, you know, this label, which is, it makes the hair on my back, look what little I have left, raised, is also subjective, because I'm sitting here with a probably much more romantic, emotional attachment to these families, because the reason that they grew the oysters was just as legitimate as the reason people do it to sell to restaurants. They grew them to harvest them, to eat them, and to keep the river clean. Some of them did it because they wanted to be part of the overall effort to make the Lynn Haven safe to grow oysters in the first place, which it wasn't 50 years ago. You couldn't even bathe in it, much or swim in it, much less, it's an old world, only bathe in it, swim in it, much less grow oysters in it. So I have to speak to the fact that just because you don't have a company and you don't grow oysters to sell to restaurants, and just because you don't put shell down to have an oyster reef to do educational purposes, doesn't mean, and I doubt, I'm going to be honest with you, I doubt very seriously they did reporting, mandatory reporting on the oysters that they did, that they gathered for their family, you know,
the requirement,
so their application can say that as well, in my opinion, you know, because it's an emotional and a lot of other reasons why people, you know, hold on to a small lease in front of waterfront property in the Lynn Haven River, not just because they're speculating or not just because they're, quote, bad actors, but because they've had it for multiple, and the son said, no, you know, we're not ready to make that decision right now. We want to hold on to it. So,
so just so you know, I get renewals like that, and first thing I do with a renewal is like I blow up the lease and I go to mandatory reporting. That's the first thing I do, okay? Because if you got it, you're home free. And I look at the report and it says, oh, you know, they harvested like 2 bushels a year.
Right.
Well, I don't expect to see anything in mandatory reporting, and I usually don't. And usually I write, if they don't put it on there, I write right on the form, recreational use. And I renew it, you know? But usually they're still pretty close to the bushel of effort. You know, if you harvest, if you have a 3-acre lease and you harvest a couple bushels a year, and they say, well, we put some shell back too. Okay, well, that's 3 bushels a year.
Have floating cages, gardener cages on the dock too, right?
I mean, the law doesn't really address recreational use. It says, you know, attempt to propagate and commercially harvest. But we understand that a lot of people have recreation, you know, small leases near their property, and they use them for their own personal use. And that's, I accommodate that because I, you know, otherwise we'll have every month in the future we'll have 5 people before the commission who have a lease or two being denied. And I think the commission's going to reinstate them. So my goal is not to bring these to the commission, okay, just so everybody knows that. That's the reason I want these guidelines, to help me and help y'all know what you need to send me so I don't have to turn anybody down. Because it's a lot of work for everybody to go to the commission. I'm going to have to write up a report. You're going to have to bring in records that you can't find. So it's not, but the law does say, and we've been told, you know, that by the administration and industry, we would like to get some of this ground out of people's hands who aren't using it.
I apologize, but can you just clarify, I'm looking at this paragraph, this 613, and it says requires significant production, reasonable planting, or significant aquaculture operation. So wouldn't that encompass everything else in the aquaculture operation like we're talking about? So isn't that in the code?
Yes, I mean, that's
okay.
Why we count floats.
Okay, so it's just like under your guidelines of other factors, the use of lease for broodstock or nursery or seed or any of the other phases, actually in that third paragraph, and maybe that would help just if that is expanded on a little bit and generalized in that paragraph instead of other may consider, then maybe that would help out a lot.
That's good. I think we can
massage
that.
Just a clarification. I agree that broodstock would be covered under general. activity. So for the purposes of the way you organize this, it looks like we've got the section that's directly tied to code, and then the section that sort of came from shotgun at you in the last meeting, another thing that we thought should be covered. So moving it there, for all practical purposes, would say that it has a direct link to the code if we move the first doc into that section.
But doesn't he says significant reduction, reasonable planting for significant agriculture operation, and in the code it says reasonable planting for no significant agriculture operation. So that all, whether it's seasonal, right?
Yeah.
Whether you're moving stuff seasonally, whether you're moving it because of a rain event, whether you moved it, right? Am I?
So I think it makes sense to move it up to the other section, and maybe that makes everyone feel a little better.
Mm-hmm.
But Andrew, do you feel better?
I have a list metrics. I have never been supportive of metrics because of the difficulties of determining metrics over a 10-year period. And I need to everyone to remember that we're looking at the metrics for 10 years, not just a single year, and that you could satisfy all the metrics in 1 year of that 10-year period and still get the lease renewed, correct?
Any time during the 10-year?
Correct. So we have to remember that we're talking about 10 years, not just Tommy's 81 bushels this year, because that 81 bushels is going to grow, obviously, and you could probably satisfy your 81 acres from this 1 year crop for the 10-year period.
Yeah, but
so we have to be careful about the metrics. We really have problems with absolute numbers. Secondly, I want to go back to the float over a lease. Do we have anyone right now with a float permit that does not have a bottom lease? I don't know of anyone that has done that.
Yeah.
There is someone? Okay. Does the production in the float over the lease that is not owned by the float owner count towards production for the bottom lease?
Oh, maybe I misspoke there. I'm saying that we've got floats with
right.
No oyster grind underneath.
Okay.
That's what we have.
Okay. It's unleased part.
Right, that's correct.
And I just wanted to go back and agree with Bev about commercial versus recreational. I think that the people that have the small leases that have been in the family for decades, that harvest for Thanksgiving and Christmas, should be considered because they're grown oysters.
And I've raised this issue with this committee, even in the work group, that this law does not really address recreational at all, and so it makes it difficult for me when I'm doing them. I agree with you. I think the reasonable person would say, you know, that you don't have to meet some commercial quantity of production to keep a lease. Maybe there's some people in the industry that don't think that because they want those leases, but I don't know how you get to that without a metric.
Yeah.
Sorry. Do you think a bushel measure per acre is still too high?
I didn't say that.
Okay. Just checking.
But you yourself pointed out that the code is already very subjective in terms of, you know, what's significant.
Right.
You know, so the code is forcing you to be very subjective in when you evaluate these renewals. I'm done. I'll stop for a while.
What this one bushel that we're kind of getting hung up on the production side is sort of doing on a staff perspective is sort of taking it and sort of saying, okay, if you meet this, you're good. And it sort of, and then everything else kicks in after that. It's sort of a way of filtering everything out. So having that in the guidelines going forward would be helpful for future staff, I think, just to sort of say, look at this first, and then look at all this other stuff. Because I think, and please jump in with examples, but anyone who's commercially using their ground is going to be meeting this metric. I mean, it's pretty low. I think even on some of the bigger bay leases, you'd be meeting that one bushel minimum level. And if you're not, then that's where everything kicks in. But if there are examples where you're using a lease to produce oysters and you're not doing that, that would be good to have, I think, on the staff level.
I think Jay has a hand up, maybe?
Yeah.
For the last 45 minutes.
It's changed a couple of times. I don't remember what I was going to say. I'll just piggyback on that. So there's a lot of concern up here about having a guideline that sort of puts guardrails around proprietary practices for each business. Everyone's made the argument that they're doing something different, that they need to be able to change. We started this conversation with the premise that we're trying to weed out bad actors. I've said this before, I'll say it half-heartedly right now. I don't know how we do that without some kind of floor for people to point to, but I guess I would turn it back on folks that are uncomfortable with what we have here and say, what if we, is there a way to define this from the bad actor perspective rather than trying to put guardrails on what we expect from the industry? Is there a different way to come at this from the activities where we want to not see occur? Because I'm sensing a great level of discomfort about people not being able to make adjustments on the fly. And let's be honest, those are not, it's not even right to call them industry practices. That's R&D, that's innovation for them when they're making these changes and there's a new form factor or there's a new threat that they need to respond to. So I get the hesitancy. So is there a way for us to come at this question that actually defines this in terms of what we're trying to prohibit? Is there a way to come up with a list of, I guess, prohibited uses on a lease rather than the things that you must do within these guidelines? And maybe there's not, and I'm sorry for even suggesting it, knowing that would blow this document up, but I feel like we should at least go consider the question, because this way feels like we're going to keep catching somebody up in the net, and their industry folks seem uncomfortable with it.
AJ Babb, and then I have to stop.
Well, I think we've done some of that. And when you look at the big picture, right now we're looking at this one singular document, but we increased the application fees substantially. Some in the industry would argue not enough. Increased the transfer fee, more scrutiny on the transfer leases now. We have another fee, it's a lease renewal fee. In my opinion, I'm interested in people being scrutinized for a lease that are waterfront landowners that say, I want the 10 acres out in front of my house to stop aquaculture or stop oystering. And I've heard it plenty of times. And then leases from the industry that want to get close to somebody else's lease because they know it's productive. I think we've done a great job as an industry to move forward to that. Some would disagree that the fees were too high and arbitrary and such. I think this is a workable document. I think it's done a nice job. I disagree with the numeric and with the quantitative metric. I think there's a floor.
Yeah.
I think there's a floor. It needs to be scrutinized at the staff level.
Even
the bad actors are.
We've got the same objective. I don't want to see these kind of taking up these waterfront, these viewshed leases. I think that's a problem. I don't know how we solve that with the fee changes. I think if you own waterfront property,
maybe got at some of the other speculative leases, but if we're trying to deal with the view shed issue, there has to be something that Andrew or Ben can look at and say, you did not meet this requirement, and therefore you have to give this lease up. And I don't know what it is. I mean, if the metric makes us uncomfortable, is there another way we can get at it? We talked about ecological services before, and that meant that you had to, it wasn't what came off the ground, but you had to demonstrate that you did something of benefit to it. You didn't just hold it. You either had to show a receipt for shell, or you had to demonstrate that there was pre-existing rock and you didn't mess with it, something that you did, something beneficial. Is that something that people are more comfortable with, is trying to define it in terms of ecological services instead of a metric for removal? I know that makes our life easier in the restoration world because we're not particularly in the business of harvesting, so we like ecological services, but the fact remains that we're not getting a view shed lease with $150 fee. There has to be a...
Well, you're not, likewise, you know, any waterfront landowner is going to be able to plant whatever metric we put on it. They'll hire somebody and spend whatever it takes to retain. So I don't think, I agree with you, the fee didn't accomplish the view shed. I think it accomplished a lot in the industry. If people are going to think twice about going out and saying, I want 250 acres in the Rappahannock next to so-and-so, when it's going to cost them $1,000. I think that did a lot.
Do you have something?
Yes, I just want to say I agree 100% with AJ. I think that when you have multiple changes over a short period of time, you might get the effect that you wanted, but you might not know which one of those things, which one of those variables might have. And I think as a mix, they've all had a positive, will all have a positive effect over time that we haven't seen yet. Doesn't mean eventually, that's right, and it doesn't mean to me that you have to do them all as hard as you can, as fast as you can, right this minute, because you don't know what that impact would be. And if it pushes people out of the industry, it'll be 100% wrong. It'll be 100% wrong. Even small people who are doing it for the right reasons, we have people all the time come to us and say, I want to learn how to be an oyster farmer. And I say, okay, meet me at the dock at 5:30 tomorrow morning. What time? Okay? So there are things. These things that we put into place, the lease renewal fees, the transfer fees, those are in and of themselves going to have an impact. And I think that having the lease renewal looked at and questioned and have to have the documentation is a good thing. But I think that's enough.
Didn't you have something you wanted to say?
I think under your other factors, I think it should also say the commission may consider other factors that are not appropriate for shellfish production or for lease renewal, and have some items in the guidelines saying that it doesn't. So not only on the positive, but also come up with some guidelines for factors that aren't appropriate.
So I have
the other factors could be the recreational harvest.
So I have a question for the committee. I'm going to try to get the wording right. When you draw up guidelines, regulations, rules, whatever, you can make them to where they are more inclusive. So by and large, you're giving people the benefit of the doubt, which means bad actors get through, right? That's part of the process. Or you can draw up guidelines that crack down on things, which means you're going to push out a few good people. Are people more inclined for the former or the latter? Would you rather us design guidelines that inevitably a few bad actors are going to stay in, but by and large most people get through? Or we have a system that is going to tighten it down, and we are going to likely eliminate almost all the bad actors, as well as a few people that are on the margins? Because that is at the heart of the matter of what we are grappling with. And you don't have to answer now. We can always come back. But that's the push and the pull in developing these guidelines, is if they are inclusive and they are far-reaching, it will help a lot of people, which is important to consider. We want to make sure that we have a diverse and varied industry large growers, small growers, recreational, but that is going to let some bad actors remain in. That's a fact. Or tighten up, and we I don't think we're going to lay the hammer down, but you know, we tighten it up and we create more guidelines, and that means people that are sitting right on those edges are probably not going to make it in, but we are also going to kick out all of those bad actors. That's where we are. I saw Becky and then Ann.
So I keep hearing the term bad actor, and it was used a lot in the Lynn Haven, and it really wasn't one that I came up with. I mean, there were people that I understood had these leases in their family, and in fact, I often spoke against it like I'm doing now. I don't think we ought to use that term.
Okay.
Because I think it means different things to different people, and a lot of the people who we were dealing with in our project who we couldn't get consent from were not being mean to us. They just weren't responding to us, and there was no process. So it was really non-actors. It was people who we knew had no harvest reports. It was people who we knew wouldn't respond when reasonable requests were made to proceed through a lease that we knew wasn't being used.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, it's the non-actors and the ones who don't show up on Bed Stock at 5:30. They may have all the good intentions in the world when they acquire a lease, but then they never do anything with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then that becomes control over that space to the extent that nobody else can do anything with it. And then it becomes inherited to the next person, and then they also have good intentions but never do anything with it. And I think that is the place where we fell into, and I think where I would like to see the effect of this renewal eliminate those types of people. So it's not the recreational users. I spoke up for those. I mean, I come from a family where there's a lot of outdoor activity, and my grandfather was a routine fisherman, and he actually drowned while fishing. It's not like I'm, you know, somebody who has no understanding of the, you know, the importance of the history of this. But what we do have to look at is, we're not talking about what happened over the last 50 years, we're talking about how is this acreage going to be used in the next 10? And the only way to know that is what those people have been doing over the last 10. And if they had all the good intentions of the world, but they never acted on it, maybe it is time to let somebody else use it. Or if they're only using a portion of it, maybe they don't need to keep the whole thing and other people can use it. And what we kept hearing from the secretary was, and from the commissioner, was these are public grounds. And so they're not meant to be a relic of someone's family history. They are meant to be put to the most beneficial use at this time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to keep that in mind. And so I don't want to see any productive lease grounds go away. And we in the city of Virginia Beach want to encourage the oyster production. But we also don't want the non-users to continue to hold. And so, I mean, I'm not going to answer your question now. I don't know the answer to that. I really don't want any active oyster leaseholder. I want you to be able to get it right every time, and I know that's not going to happen. But as long as we have good guidelines where people looking at them make the best judgment they can in each case, then I feel like we made a big step from how it used to be.
Thank you for that. I think that's a really good point, because at one of the previous meetings, we'd gone around the table to try to define what a bad actor was, and that was a fascinating exercise because everyone had different definitions. And I think bad actor ascribes intent. So I really like the non-actor use, because it's just, for whatever reason, they haven't done anything on it, best of intentions, couldn't get up at 5:30, like whatever happened. So I think that is a really interesting and possibly better way to phrase that. Ann? Okay.
Respectfully, I think there's non-actors, but I also think there are bad actors of, like AJ said, taking up ground so no one else is in front of your house, or not using it, or trying to sneak. onto somebody else's ground. And I think the problem is that you have a panel up here that aren't bad actors. And so we know it's happening and we see it happening, but we don't know necessarily, one, how to go about it and stop it. And we could probably sit here off record and say, you know, this person, and this person do it. But how do you capture that? And it's, and like Dave said, it might be better from your perspective of saying, oh, well, we've heard about this guy and we've heard about that guy. So let's present these case studies and maybe we can tease something out that they're doing. I'm sure that there's some common threads through the bad apples that are doing this. So if we can tease out some of that detail and add it to these guidelines, I feel much better.
Jack.
So it feels like the LCD for bad actors is doing nothing. And which again brings us back to this question of you have to have something to hold it up against. If the common thread is they've done absolutely nothing on the ground, and then we, I'm not married to any methodology, just want Ben to have a good reason to say no, so he can stand before the commission and say, they didn't do anything, here's why I'm saying no, it's in your guideline, and he doesn't get thrown under the bus when they come up and with a sob story. If you're not doing something on the release, that is not in the, that is not my public trust document, that is not a benefit to the Commonwealth. It is not a benefit to all the other folks that are working here where if that water was doing something productive and it was actually benefiting you in ways and business leases, it is, if they're not having any measurable benefit, then we need a way to cleanly get them out. And I don't, again, not married to a specific methodology, but I want to give Ben and future Ben the proper protection for when they stand before the commission to say, this is why I'm saying no, that the commission will not reverse them, or, you know, go against that decision as has happened in the past when leases were recommended for not being renewed. We need to set some guardrails. Before I finish, flip side of that. I say this every meeting, I'm going to say it again. This is about regulatory surety for our industry. We are at a time where we have a secretary who wanted to sit down with you, who wanted to follow up, and this group was created in the aftermath of last year's work group. We could be 2 years away from a governor that does not know that this agency exists. We do not know what's going to happen in the future. We do know that it's a really loud voice, and a lot of people that are on the waterfront have a disproportionate voice in electoral politics. That is something everyone should be mindful of. You are not just writing something that will constrain you. You are writing something that will protect you in the future. And I really cannot stress that enough, that we have, there are plenty of reasons in Virginia to have no idea what you do and don't understand why it matters. And so it's very, very important to make sure you take advantage of the conversation with the representative.
So I will add to Jay's point. I think what Jay was saying is we definitely want to give staff good guidelines when we go before the commission, right? A person's not a policy. And so Mark Lufenbach, who's on the phone and texted me this comment because it's sort of hard for people to chime in from the phone, which I think is a really good comment. So what he said is the dichotomy that you, that I set up in the last question is a little strong in terms of the, like, do we let bad actors in? Do we kick people out? And he said, a slightly more restrictive set of guidelines would catch more non and bad actors, and an appeal process to the commission could reinstate those good actors who inadvertently got flashed by the guidelines, which I think is an interesting way to look at that. Kim.
So after having been here now for about an hour and 45 minutes and listening to all of this, I think the one thing that I'm hearing, and I'd like maybe for all of you staff to chime in or everybody up here to chime in, the one thing that I've heard from industry is that they don't like the one bushel per acre per year. And I think what I've also heard is that everybody feels like the document that we have here is a good starting point with the exception of that matrix. Is that, would that be clear to say? Ask? And I don't know if that's a show of hands or what that is. In an effort to kind of move this to another,
yeah.
To zone in on what it is that is being rebuffed.
Okay.
Can I just ask a clarifying question?
Yes, and I have one too.
Okay, so the way I understood what you were saying earlier about the one bushel per acre per year is it's sort of like the, in Monopoly when you do not, you know, just go straight to the go, you restart, and it's automatically you get there because you've shown that, and you don't need to look at anything else. The rest of this is if you just don't meet that, that these are the guidelines that you're going to look at to see beyond that. Is that what we're doing, or is it an and?
I was with you right until the end, so I'm explaining to you how I think this works and how we've talked about it. It's renewal application comes in, it lists its productivity, and we look at that productivity and we say that meets the criteria of one bushel of effort per acre per year. You're going to renew this lease. Lease number renewal two comes in and it does not meet that criteria. And we say, okay, what else do we have here? Was this lease part of a broader effort for that company to use for the reasons Tommy laid out? Was this a result of MSX or Dermo? Do they have the test? Does it meet any of erosion control? Was it rotation with other leased areas? Like what is it that would still qualify this lease for renewal? So just because it doesn't meet the one bushel per acre of effort, one bushel of effort per acre per year, does not mean that lease is going to get denied. It just means it's additional review for staff. So we're trying to create some transparent thing for you all in terms of what needs to be done. I think the question I have this is a weird question. If we were to use that but not write that down, like if it's not in the guidelines, that's something that staff is just likely going to use, or we're going to go to mandatory reporting, like we need a starting point. We're going to start somewhere. Does that give people less pause? Is it the fact that we have it written down? Because again, to be clear, if you don't meet that standard, it just means we kick you to the next level of review, to the things that are specifically written in the code, and then the things that we have added per your input. So it is just a starting point. Jay.
And it doesn't go anywhere else, right? It's just a fast track pile. If you meet that standard, it would just automatically be renewed versus looking at this longer. It's making it sound like there's an additional process. I'm wondering if there's anything meaningfully different other than additional than staff going further down the page.
I mean, we're working through this process, so
yeah.
I'm looking at Ben now. If I think that largely would be, if you would move.
Yeah, I think she captured it. If you don't have production, remember, production is not just harvest. It's if you plant a shell. They give you a bushel of credit for a bushel of shell, okay? It's a lot different than a bushel of harvest. And seed, that's a little tougher for us because seed are tiny. I understand, Tommy. But I factor that in, and I can't give you a formula. Figured out how to do clams, at least for harvest, because they're reported first. We know how many clams makes a bushel. We know what size of the clam, we know what size most clams are that are harvested. So, again, if you meet that criteria, you're in. And you're right. If you don't, then we have to look at what else you put on the form. And we wrote down all these things that we think could qualify based on your input and what's in the code. I would like to see a show of hands of how many people think we should take out a bushel of effort. Should that not even be in this guideline? That's really giving everybody that much heartburn or not?
It depends on how it's used, interpreted, and applied.
What'd you say, Tom? I can hear you.
It depends on how it's used, interpreted, and applied. You know, if, like you said, if it doesn't meet the one bushel, did they have significant aquaculture
operational things going on with other leases and combined with that one lease, then yeah, that's fine. But
yeah. For effort in wild harvest.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
Yeah.
Correct.
Aquaculture doesn't cover that.
Yes, you're right.
Dan?
I realize you guys have been working on this. I know we missed last month's meeting. You guys have been working on this for 2 months. I apologize. I didn't really take a close look at it until Friday. So I'm still kind of chewing on all of it. So before I make a rash, I would say that I'd like to, at minimum, see that production standard go to other factors. And I'd rather see the mandatory reporting take a step up. And then if it's not mandatory reporting on that lease, then taking into consideration all mandatory reporting for that leaseholder would be my second standard in that paragraph. And then have that metric go to the other factors. Again, and we've only been chewing on this for less time than you guys have, so I respectfully put that out there.
So as I stated, Anne brings up a good point. As I stated at the top of the session today, we were not trying to get to any decision points. We were not trying to get to any consensus, and I would rather not call for any votes or shows of hands because it's hard sometimes in a public setting. I want everybody to have the freedom to think this over. Right? These are big decisions. These are hard decisions, and I don't want to lock anybody into anything today. So as I posed sort of the initial dichotomy, the reason I didn't call for sort of answers is because it's something to think about. So it is 5:15-ish, 5:20. And so what I propose for next steps on this is that staff goes back and reconvenes and incorporates input and have conversations on what we've heard today and sort of what the next step would look like, what mandatory harvest, mandatory reporting would look like. And then next time we can come back with a different iteration, another iteration of this document. This will be an iterative process. And we can again start to look at that. As we do that, that's sort of the homework I would give to the committee, or what I would request the committee think about is, particularly as we look into mandatory reporting, how should we deal with what can be sizable discrepancies in mandatory reporting? How do we deal with that in terms of how should or if that should affect renewal?
Could you explain how you're identifying the discrepancies?
Yeah. So I get the form.
Right.
And it says how many bushels of oysters or clams did you harvest?
Now I understand.
And they put down 500. And I go to mandatory reporting, and they have zero.
Right.
Or they have 100. And sometimes it's the other way. Sometimes I go to mandatory reporting, and they have 1,000 bushels of harvested on the form, and they put 400. Now that might be a memory. They couldn't remember what they did. But if you're reporting mandatory harvest, you have a record.
Yep.
You filled out the mandatory reporting. You should have kept a copy of it, I would think.
Sometimes that doesn't always work. Sometimes you can't actually print. I think it's improved a lot. But we do it through the computer for a while, and we've tried to print it out. Sometimes it says it's processes. We couldn't get it to print. Now we actually do it by hand so that we have the paper trail. We reverted back to the original forms because it doesn't always take out the form. So, and we never get, like, we get that we've reported, like, once a month we get that we've done all the reporting, but we never get, like, a tally per month of what we actually said, which might be helpful. And then we could keep a little bit of better record, but we get the 999 for the 12 months per year, but we don't get you reported this much for this month for February or whatever. So maybe instead of just getting a code of 999, we get a yearly summary of what we actually reported, and that might actually help for our attendance.
So I'd like to, wrapping towards the end of the day, I think one of the things that has come to light is how we can improve mandatory reporting for both reporters and the agency. And so I'd love to have a conversation offline with you or if anybody else wants to participate around some of the challenges on mandatory reporting. Because you can request your own data, and they can give that to you. That's an additional step. So I will put a pin in that to work on improving that. Jay, do you have one comment before I provide wrap-up?
No, it sounds like you all are going to work on it. I, I have a lot of questions about how mandatory reporting would be calculated to cover all of the police.
Okay.
So I'm interested in seeing how that would shake out.
Okay. And what we will,
I just have one comment before you wrap up. Mm-hmm. And we have had, I guess, several comments now today and before about actors. Bad actors, now non-actors, I get it. That's maybe a better term. But as we look at this and we try and wrap our hands around non-actors and bad actors, we have some good actors.
Mm-hmm.
Those good actors are going to have to do the additional paperwork and the additional criteria that we're talking about. And I get it, if you're a good actor, that's what you do, you're in the business, then that's what you should do. But I just want to be mindful that a lot of this tedious paperwork and filing and things are going to come back on the people that have been and will continue to do this thing the right way. To get this, whatever percentage that is, of bad actors or non-actors. So we're in this all together, but I just want to be mindful that, you know, this also impacts the industry that's trying to do the right thing out there.
Well put. So next steps, we will go back as staff and sort of and work through this and give this another iteration, incorporating some of the input. You all go back and I imagine talk to your respective people and get some additional feedback. We will look at mandatory reporting, sort of see what that looks like. The other thing that we can try to do is bring forward leases that were denied. Or scenarios such, right? Any lease that we would bring forth that would be denied, we may do it looking way back, right? So we're not dealing with current actors and there's confidentiality issues and all this stuff. So I'm saying we might be able to do that. I would try to bring that forward in a tabletop setting to give you a sense of what that would look like, because there is confidentiality. But we'll try to bring something forward to give you a sense of what that might look like and how that might work. Kim?
And I'm asking you to refresh your memory for us, but you gave us a statistic. I don't think it was at these AMAC meetings. I think it was probably in the secretary's work group about what percentage of leases have been denied in the last 10 years. I think I recall you gave us.
I probably get it wrong, but historically it was like 3% or something.
Okay, thank you.
What I also did, you know, if I went back last year and reassessed them using sort of quasi with this guidelines, you know, that it would shoot up to like 30-40% because you couldn't meet the one pushing. I didn't see the problem with trying to go retrospectively back is that if you don't meet some criteria, you know, it doesn't look like you really did much. We didn't go back to them and say, oh, did you use this for education? Did you, you know, because some of that still isn't in the code. These are new things we've come up with. So looking back, I think I would have denied them, but maybe I wouldn't, you know, maybe if they contacted me and said, oh, well, wait a minute. You know, I did this, this, and this. But just taking the raw, you know, numbers, going back and looking at them, all I had is the sheet.
Right.
Get any follow-up, you know, it would go up considerably.
I apologize. I'm asking you to try to feedback. But of those 3%, do you recall any of them going before the commission to be appealed?
I think Hank had one or two.
Got two in the last 30 years.
And they reinstated them both.
And they came up and said, we've done nothing, but we want to. And I'm 85 years old, so, you know, they got them back.
So my last thing for your homework is, no matter who you are as a leaseholder, if you have 10 leases over 10 years, there's one lease out of 10 you did not do anything on, then you think I should renew that lease. You can't show you did anything on that lease, but you do, you're producing more than all the rest of them. Should I renew that? I don't know if he's a good actor, bad actor. He's producing oysters, so he would probably fall into good actor, if you want to call it that, or an actor versus a non-actor. But on the one lease, he's a non-actor.
So my immediate response to that would be, are we not allowed to grow? I mean, and I get it, you've had it for 10 years. Maybe a small grower, again, the parameters, maybe a small grower that doesn't have the financial wherewithal, but can, I don't know.
That's the conundrum I'm in, okay?
Yeah.
You know, if you say, well, we're a big company, you know us, you know we produce, and we have a grand plan. The grand plan is eventually someday we'll use all our leases. Sometime in the next 100 years. Okay. The law says, 10 years, did you do anything? That's the conundrum I'm in. Whether it's a good actor, bad actor, non actor, established company, non established, and that was the problem I had with the one I denied. It was established company, growing orchard, gangbusters. And that was one of the things they came back and said, well, it's future expansion. Okay, is that it? Is that the only thing you can tell me? And they didn't. They gave some other things. But I'm not sure would I have been convinced to renew it if they just said, we're holding this one for future expansion.
Okay, so let me ask you a question then. If the scenario you talk about is a lease of one of many that might not be reported on or might not have activity for 10 years. The alternative being you would not renew that lease and it would become unassigned. Is that better to BMRC that it's unassigned and sits there? Well, you didn't say that, but you were saying should I renew it? So if you don't renew it, then there's no revenue coming to, well, actually this revenue would go back to the general fund as a lot of the revenue does. But let's be honest and be mindful of the revenue that goes to the general fund. If we have increased application fees, went through all the fees that we've increased, there is going to be some entities, some individuals, some businesses that are going to drop leases. So they're not going to get the $1.50 an acre. You're not going to get the renewal fee. You're not going to get these fees. So there's going to be limited revenue coming back to the general fund, and therefore, how does General Assembly look at, hey, we don't have as much of the general fund coming to BMRC. So I think that's something you also have to think about. Is it better to have ground fallow and sitting there on the side, or making something off of that ground where a business says we might use it in our business plan at some point?
And I think I will weigh in on that as well, because it's not just It is a benefit to the Commonwealth more broadly, to both the government and the citizens. So is there someone else who wants that ground and would use it, thus generating, you know, a different set of fees than the Commonwealth? Like, it's a really hard calculus to make, and I think it's my initial reaction is sort of a dangerous sort of path to go down, because then you're trying to weigh out, like, well, if we let this one go, that's $500 to Commonwealth, but we can keep that one and it's $1,000 to Commonwealth. I think it's an interesting idea. It doesn't something to consider, but I think that does give me.
The Commonwealth doesn't consider the fees the public good. That's not its good.
Right.
So it's not a consideration that the state makes that they're generating revenue, or else I feel like we already would have been on a one-way path towards maximizing agriculture production only on leases, and they would basically be. We have a ton of stuff that it has nothing to do with revenue generation that is a completely legitimate use of a state lease and should be because it has a benefit to the state. I also do, I'll leave it there for now. I agree. I think that's a dangerous path to go down when you start telling the state to start holding on to leases for that small income when the objective is not to generate a fee, it is to maximize the public good, which means a lot of things in the code.
Yes. I'm looking at my calendar. Somehow it became September. So September 9th would be our next scheduled meeting.
I'd be selfish and ask that it be the 16th, 1 week later.
Yep, I'll be in Bermuda.
I'll be in Bermuda, go for it.
Well, on the 9th, I'll be in Italy.
Okay.
I'll be on the oyster farm.
At 5:30. We can. I can send out a quick note to everybody. That way, if people want to have some flexibility about the 9th or the 16th. What did you say? If there's no strong objections moving to the 16th, that's fine. I will send out a follow-up email this week, sort of covering what some of the things we would like for you guys to think about. Along that list of questions will be sort of how often do you want to continue to meet? We've been meeting monthly. We took July off to give staff some time to try to tackle this. And also because we needed to do the regulatory rulemaking with the commission. Something to think about as we go through that.
Did you settle with the 16th?
Well,
I think
that
could be a poll.
Okay, but we may also have a staff issue of the international shellfish something or other.
Interstate shellfish.
That's the regional. So we'll send out a note. We have heard that a couple people cannot make the 9th. We've heard people cannot make the 16th. I don't know when the ISS does that, whatever.
ISSC is in October.
Okay.
Yeah,
this
is the
we'll send it out in an email.
There's no reason why I can't be
sued. 9th and 9th. Oh, and 9th is Labor Day.
We work.
Good luck on getting us.
Yeah, I think staff would put snakes in my office, and I like it snake free. So we will come back on a date. We will send out questions to think about. Really appreciate everybody's candor and help with this as we try to continue to wrestle this to the ground. So thank you very much, and hope you guys all have a great night. All right. Oh, yeah. I know. But my thing is that I need to work with staff. Minimum is to make me work with staff. No, you don't get me.